Dzień dobry Państwu. Nazywam się Hanna Wróblewska, jestem dyrektorką Zachęty Narodowej Galerii Sztuki, gdzie mamy przyjemność Państwa gościć. Witam Państwa na konferencji Cold Revolution, której autorami są Joanna Kordiak oraz Jérôme Bazin. Jérôme, sorry for my pronunciation. Ta konferencja współorganizowana jest przez Instytut Adama Mickiewicza. Pani dyrektor, bardzo Pani dziękuję. Oraz Université Créteil w Paryżu. Naszym partnerem jest Czeskie Centrum oraz Filmoteka Narodowa FINA. I teraz chyba powinnam oddać głos autorce. Jérôme, Joanna, the floor is yours.
Good morning. Thank you all for coming so early in the morning. So we are very grateful to all our speakers who accepted our invitation and are willing to share with us the results of their current research in different fields. And many thanks to Zofia Machnicka, Małgorzata Miśkowiec from Institute of Adam Mickiewicz for their support. And of course, our great team in Zachęta, Zofia Koźniewska, Michał Kubiak, and Marta Milch and others. We hope that this conference will provide an opportunity to all of you to be inspired by sharing knowledge and reflection about this period. And it will also be a great opportunity for us, for me and Jérôme, to discuss together a few issues which will play a key role in the exhibition planned in Zachęta in October. So let us briefly review main topics of the conference.
Yes. Thanks, Joanna. And I want also to thank the Zachęta Gallery and the Adam Mickiewicz Institute for this possibility to explore our research with this exhibition. So to start this introduction, a few words about this title and the different elements of the title. The main word in this title is revolution. It is really the central topic for us. We consider the 50s as a period of revolution, and we would like to discuss this revolutionary dimension. During the 50s, the word revolution was mainly used in reference to the military and political context. The revolution was the end of the war and the liberation by the Red Army, or it was a moment when communists took power at the end of the 40s. The definition of revolution in both cases could be discussed further. But what we understand by revolution is different. It is, for us, the social reversal, the series of great transformations, that is, industrialization, development of an industrial working class, urbanization, transformation of the countryside through collectivization, experience of social mobility, downward mobility, and upward mobility. Revolution is the transition from a rural society to a urban society. We insist on this division, rural-urban, because it is a key problem for us, and we think for this decade, and it is the main narrative we are struggling with. The two categories, rural-urban, has created a narration about society, about modernization of society, and each category was, and we think still is, associated with some characteristics. And the 50s in East Central Europe is a very good laboratory to question and to criticize this narrative and all these associations along the two categories. Thanks to the geographical differences inside Eastern Central Europe and the variety of cases we have here. Why in the title this adjective cold? Why cold revolution? The word cold is, of course, it refers to the geopolitical context and to the Cold War. But let us remind that the expression Cold War was a Western concept, and it had no equivalent at this time in the East Central European languages. We prefer another interpretation of cold revolution. The social revolution happened in a context of hard dictatorship. The 50s were a period of rigid political thinking and a period of incredible political violence, from the Stalinist violence to the post-de-Stalinized violence. So cold refers to this icy political climate. I let you explain the subtitle.
Yes. Yeah. The subtitle is Central and Eastern Europe in the Face of the Socialist Realism. Let's begin with the term socialist realism. In the 50s, of course, in the 30s, in the Soviet Union, in the 50s, in the Central and Eastern Europe, it was used to exclude or condemn. We don't want to do what the ideologues did in the Stalinist period, putting labels on works of art. Our goal is not to answer the question, is it socialist realism or not? As we know, socialist realism could be plural, ambiguous, and ill-defined. We consider different forms of the socialist realism, including variations, divergences, personal appropriation, everything we can describe as margins of socialist realism. Margins does not mean opposition to socialist realism, it's more deviance. A secondary question for us is if these works of art were accepted by authorities or rejected, neglected, ignored. In this sense, we want to go beyond the dichotomy official and unofficial. For instance, if we look a painting by Gladyslav Guderna, a Slovak painter, we can see how he adjusted the demands of socialist realism in his own way. He gave his own painting formula of socialist realism, combining his pre-war avant-garde experience with inspiration of popular art and finally with a socialist realist iconography. Let's see a similar example. Is German painter Will Zilte and of course famous avant-garde painter Hans Matthias Tolt from Romania. Our starting point is the social revolution, the reality of the social processes, and we look at the works of art to find connection with this reality. We disagree with the claim that socialist realism had no connection with reality. According to this thesis, already stated by Albert Camus in 1957 and elaborated by Evgeny Dobrenko, socialist realism was a spectacle that created another reality. It did not represent reality, it replaced reality. It's these connections that we would like to consider in our discussion. We would like to see how selected objects and works of art are related to the social context of the period. We hope to bring the reality around the socialist realist objects. And the second part of the title, the first part of the subtitle is Central and Eastern Europe. We bring together six, now seven countries. Poland is Germany, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Romania and Bulgaria. The space East Central Europe was certainly not homogeneous, and the spatial category corresponds to a Western point of view, which embraces different regions in one area. Without neglecting national differences, each country has, of course, its own chronology during the 50s, its own artistic legacy, and its own social history. One of our first goals is to connect the collection from these seven countries and to see what we can do in the terms of comparison. This comparative approach provides us the opportunity to analyze the social history and especially the topic urban-rural.
Now, briefly, we would like to present the four sessions we will have today and tomorrow. Today we will speak about time and space. The first session will be about time, the second about space. So the first session about time and periodization, about the place of the 50s during 20th century, and about the specific temporal experiences during this very particular decade. We would like, as you said, to compare the different chronologies, in particular the end of the 50s, with the different cultural policies and the different answers to these policies corresponding to different individual temporalities. Important point and arguable point, we don't consider only the Stalinist time, 49-53. We consider the whole decade from 48 to 59. So we go beyond the usual watershed from 56. We do that in order to grasp the originality of this temporal experience during the decade. We show you here three architectural creations in Hungary. In each case, the temporality is an issue. the three cases have in common to have been quickly out of date. And we would like to discuss this idea of being out of date in the 50s. The first is the Memos, sorry for my pronunciation in Hungarian, the Memos modernist building in Budapest, representative to the, of the legacy of modern architecture and art in the region. And the construction began in 46, so when modern art was tolerated in the region, and it was finished in 50, when modern art was banished. The second image is the project, the model for the center of the new town Donaujváros, still in Hungary. That's the Hungarian socialist new town. The construction was launched during Stalinism, but it was interrupted by Stalin's death. So what you see, this model, was only incompletely realized, accomplished. The last image is the synchronization studio near Budapest. It is a socialist realist architecture completed in the late 50s at a time of de-Stalinization. So it leads to a discussion about perseverance of socialist realism in the late 50s and about the end of socialist realism. I let you present the second session.
The second panel will be about the space of socialist realism. Socialist realism is not specific to Central Eastern Europe. It was present, of course, in Soviet Union, but also in Western Europe and extra-European socialist and communist countries like China or Mexico. Here, the main question is how open Central Eastern Europe was in the 50s. The decade is often presented as a period of isolation, especially the Stalinist time. There was a general climate of fear and suspicion towards strangers. That is what we call mutual defiance. We would like to find a critical distance towards the past official discourse about fraternity and solidarity and towards current historiography about circulations and exchanges without underestimating them. For instance, the painting by André Fougeron about the exploitation of French miners. It's from a famous series Pale de Mine acquired by National Museum in Bucharest in the 50s. Invites us to critically analyze the reception of the Western socialist realism by the local audiences and artists. This gouache by about Chinese workers was made by a Romanian artist, and it questions the interest in extra-European art. Was it just an exotic, shallow orientalist appeal? What does it say about the relationship of this region to the world? The second day will be about the core idea of the exhibition, the working class and its relationship to socialist realism. The first panel will be entitled The Celebration of Working Class and Proletarization of Art. Democratization of culture, or more generally, education, was crucial in the socialist context. It contributed to the egalitarian ideal. Culture should be brought to workers, and workers should be producers of culture, hence the amateur movement. The valorization of workers meant a proletarization of art in the sense of an adaptation of art to a proletarian context. One of the disciplines we would like to include in the exhibition is applied art for workers. Let's look at the fascinating case of Zdeněk Kovář, a Czechoslovak designer from School of Applied Art in Žilin. And his product and of tools and machines. His photography shows his pioneering research on ergonomic aspect of work. Socialist realism was supposed to valorize workers and to make them confident. Workers should be proud of themselves and feel important. A Marxist ideologue would say self-conscious, but it's not exactly the same as to feel powerful, because workers had no power and they're not supposed to have power. Yesterday, we saw some Polish movies from this period about the topic of work, industry, and working class. The question is, what was the meaning of these images for workers? The most interesting question for us is not how the workers saw themselves in socialist realism art, but how they really wanted to perceive them.
The fourth session, this last session, it will be about the diversity of the working class, the different faces of the working class. The term working class was very vague, and it brought together peasants, industrial workers, qualified workers, unqualified workers, men, women, and people from different national origins. So behind the alleged unity between workers, the 50s were a period of intense conflict between workers in a context of competition and of individualism due to Stakhanovism. How can we connect works of art with this issue? It is, for us, one of the most interesting questions for the conference and the exhibition. This sculpture, the founder, an Hungarian sculptor, participates to the celebration of the worker you told about right now, and we will speak about in the session four. But for this session, we just want to stress one point. This worker is obviously a metal worker. He works in a metal factory. But when we look closely at his face, we see visual features that remind us image of peasant from before socialist time. And the same sculpture did in the 60s several sculptures about peasants. So do we have here an image of a peasant that became a worker? What kind of worker do we have here? It is finally not so easy to say, and it's what we find interesting. Maybe it represented something like an unsettled identity, to borrow a contemporary expression by Roger Brubaker. And during the 50s, many identities were actually unsettled. And we take this example, and we'll finish with that. We take this example because it is also interesting for the method. The more we look at him, and the more we know about social history of this time in Hungary and in Eastern Europe, the more interesting and ambiguous the sculpture becomes. The sculpture invites us to this approach, to look closely to the works of art from this time and to mobilize considerations about societies in order to make the works of art understandable, ambiguous, and so visible. That's our goal.
Yes. Yep. Before we begin the first panel with just a few technical explanations, during the conference we'll be accompanied by information staff. Our colleague will help you with everything you may need. You can also pick up the headphones if you need it, because the whole conference will be translated from Polish into English and from English in Polish. Finally, last but not least, all participants are invited for coffee and lunch breaks, which will take place in the workshop room. So you have to go across the exhibition of Radek Szlaga. So that's.
So we let the participant, the chairwoman of the first session.